Thank you for choosing LawLine.com for your CLE needs. Please note there's an embedded verification code placed in this podcast. It is recommended that you write down this code as you will need it to receive your credit at the end of the course. After you have completed the program, you must fill out the evaluation form by clicking the Get Credits button on the podcast page. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at support@lawline.com. Thank you and enjoy.
In the very beginning of the presentation, you can find my contact information. Phone number 212-316-0381. Website is patentlawny.com. Again, it's patentlawny.com and also patentlawnj.com. When we're at it, patentlawpa.com. With locations New York City, Passaic, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. And this is what I do for a living. So, and you can look at my website, patentlawny.com. You can see some of my sample patents. Some of them I'm actually going to be referencing today and talking about this. So, going on to the next slide, the outline of today's presentation. First, we're going to have a little introduction, a little what to look at in the office action and see some crazy office actions. And then we're going to go into step two, which is drafting a patent with the office action in mind. It might seem in today's topics responding to an office action, but the process really starts in how you draft the application. Then third, we're going to talk about non-prior art rejections, which are 101 rejections. And I'm assuming to the people I'm talking to, when I say a 101 rejection or a 102 rejection, you know what I'm talking about. This isn't an intro to patent law class. This is actually, once you're already doing it, this is actually the meat and potatoes when you're actually practicing. And then number four is prior art rejections, 102, 103 rejections. Those are rejections over previous patents, patent applications, anything. The examiner interview, when you talk to the examiner at the patent office. And finally, once we've done all that, you're ready to write your response to the office action, and you put it in writing. So moving on, so we're at the introduction section. And the next slide, quick background to the process. So just to give you a little roadmap of what we're talking about here today, in the patent process, if you look at that slide, first you receive your disclosure from the inventor, you generally conduct a novelty search. After the novelty search, then you draft your patent application, you file at the patent office, you wait, depending on how you file it, less than 1 year if you're using the pilot program to get them to respond quicker, or sometimes I've had one office action come in 4 months after filing without such a thing. In other cases, you wait up to 5 years. So once you get that office action, that's what we're going to talk about. The office action is the substantive examination by an examiner at the patent office and your now preparation and response to it. So a little circle there on the process there, the arguments and amendments, that's where we are right now. That's what we're going to talk about today. So, as many of you probably know, I'm talking to mostly lawyers in the audience here, there's a lot of treatises and there's a lot of courses and so forth on things like claim drafting, on procedural things, on memorizing the MPEP as we all had to do to pass the patent bar exam and so forth, but I think there's a lot of room for how to get to responding to an office action. And I also, before we go into the next slide, I also preface by saying this is it's a little bit of an art how you respond to an office action. Some of it is exacting. Some of it is you have to respond, you know, basically there's formalities, there's the way that you structure your office action. But some of it is also an art. How do you put your arguments together and so forth? So I make no claims to saying that this is that what I'm going to teach is the only right way to respond to an office action. I'm giving a lot of my methods, what I've developed over years of doing this, and how I do this. And having said that, I had one person comment to me, he's been doing this for 37 years, but he can always learn something. You can always learn something new. So I'm going to hopefully give you my take on how to respond to an office action, some of which I've developed, a lot of which I've learned from the people who taught me, which I'm very grateful to, and they might be watching. And in any case, thank you. And in any case, we're going to go on with that, and also to say this is, of course, not necessarily legal advice. Please don't think this is legal advice. This is presentation for teaching. So on the next slide, response to crazy office action. This is a real case here. And this is a real, how you respond to such a thing. And again, there's no one right answer, but here's what I did. So the claim in the application was, claim 7, was a device of claim 1, I'm just giving you the part that we need to talk about, wherein said device is coupled to a neutral wire. Okay, so that's a claim in your patent application. The device is coupled to a neutral wire. Office action says, see HART 5B. That's it. Let's explain. What do you mean HART 5B? So HART 5B, presumably he means figure 5B of the HART reference. He did actually say what patent the HART reference was. So we look at figure 5B in HART. So go on to the next slide. And again, that's under the heading response to a crazy office action. Now, figure 5B is this XY graph with time in the X-axis, amplitude in the Y-axis, and a current signal. Does anybody out there watching this live or afterwards on the recorded video, does anyone out there see a neutral wire in that figure? If you do, okay, you're on the examiner's side, but personally I don't. So I have a telephone interview, and I try and talk to the examiner. He refuses to discuss this claim. Every time I point to this, and he refuses to discuss the dependent claims in general, he wants to talk about the independent claim. Because I was willing to say, okay, there's some things in the independent claim, and his supervisor is on the phone too. So there's examiners, there's supervisors, you can go up the chain of command as well. There's different ways. I'm not really talking about that so much today in terms of appeals and petitions and so forth. I'm just talking about the response to the office action itself. Stay tuned, I might give a class on pre-appeals and appeals and so forth, but for now, talk about the office action. So after 20 minutes of this back and forth, the examiner finally says, look, here's why I didn't give you a proper response to that. He says, we're so pressed for time. Right now, I mean, this goes back and forth, but right now is the time I'm giving this video presentation. The examiners are under tremendous pressure to reduce the backlog. One examiner told me that they're trying to get the backlog down to 6 months from 5 years in some art units, that they're trying to get down to 6 months, they're going to get you the first office action. That's their goal right now. And they have each of their cases listed on their computer docket, and it goes, I think, from green to orange, means they're about to have a run out of time to respond, to red, and if they don't get that response out, they're in trouble. And they're given a ridiculous amount of work that they have to do in a short amount of time. So it's a common refrain, they say, look, we just don't have enough time to do it. So what that means for us as practitioners is, unfortunately, right now the pendulum has swung in a way that sometimes we're getting not so good office actions. On the other hand, I've also gotten a lot of allowances, because that's the other way they can dispose of a case, is to allow it and let it issue. But either way, whatever the case is when you're listening to this presentation, whether you're given more or less time, you got to spell it out clearly. You got to make your arguments short, concise, spell them out, and you got to hopefully reach the examiner and talk to them, converse with them, get on the good side, you know. Let them know that you know, it's not personal. There's nothing against them. You stick to your legal arguments. And you just make the best arguments you can, and you go through the process the best you can. And it's probably good advice for life as well. So, all right, we're on to the next section. Drafting your patent with the office action in mind. So what I'm going to talk about in this section is, there's certain things that you can do when drafting your patent application to anticipate common rejections. So going on to the next slide, drafting your patent application with the office action in mind. Remember that time thing I spoke about? Some examiners will only read the claims. They're not really going to read much more than the claims. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. There's some very good examiners that'll read your whole application and point out a grammatical error you had on page 16. Does happen. But the claims are the key to the patent application. So make sure that every one of your key terms in the claim is defined. You want to avoid a 112 rejection. I've had rejections where I've said, for example, this could be X, Y, or Z, and the examiner will reject it and say, that's not a definition, that could also include Q, which I rejected it over. So now I make sure to write it more clearly, spell it out. This limitation is defined as, define it. There's a definition you can refer back to. You might want to give other examples, other definitions and things if you have to amend your claims later. So that's, you know, another thing to make sure of. And other examples are, if you say substantially, define the word substantially. This one, a couple years ago, people use substantially all over patent applications. All of a sudden, rejections started coming all over the place. 112 rejection. I don't know what substantially is. You didn't define substantially. So, I mean, sometimes my definition is as simple as substantially parallel as understood by one of ordinary skill in the art. You know, we're using the Fossetta test. And that seems to be valid. I've never gotten a rejection when I substantially use that definition. Usually I give other definitions just in case, because you never know. You can't add new matter, you can't add things later. So I haven't tried that one by itself. I think it would work, but again, I would still recommend, you know, if you can put in better definitions, put in more exacting definitions, hey, that's all the better. So again, I just spoke about this, have backup terminology and variations in case you need to amend later. You know, you might have your amendments in mind in some cases. Use signals so you can find the variations. For example, you might use the term alternative embodiment. It's best not to use preferred embodiment or and language such as that, because there's a court case that says, oh, you preferred this, that means you don't prefer this, and we're not giving you the infringement benefits because on your alternative embodiment because you said you didn't prefer it. So we make all embodiments equal. And again, defined as X and Y. It's something I like to do, is just plain old use the word defined. So there's no question what you mean, and when you get a rejection that says because you use the word parallel and they cite something else that's technically parallel, then you say, no, here's my definition of parallel. Parallel is not the best example because that is a mathematical definition. You know, something more amorphous. Once you give the definition and they cite something else that matches in keyword but not in definition, you can just point to that in your office action and say, here's the definition, examiner. They usually say, here's the definition. Here's, in response to the office action, here's the definition. Don't make it personal. Then it's very easy then to overcome these things. Otherwise they say, well, I can read your claim as broadly as will allow, and it could read on my definition too. It's a way of avoiding that. It's a good step to take. Alright, so moving on to the actual parts of the patent application. The background, as many of you know or should know, it's an optional section. I'm not going to talk about when you should, when you shouldn't put it in. You know, there's different schools of thought on that, but what I will say is you can use the background section to your advantage. You can discuss the prior art. You can sell your invention to the patent office. In the prior art, it accomplishes perpetual motion. You have perpetual motion, but the perpetual motion isn't through the space-time continuum. So that's a problem, and nobody's been able to figure that out, and that would really make it much better, because then Marty wouldn't have had to go to 88 miles an hour. He could have gone to 22 and made it without the whole thing, but then we wouldn't have Back to the Future 2 and 3, and it would be, you know, I don't know, that would be a whole mess. But in any case, you can sell it to the examiner. You can tell the examiner what you're talking about, where to search. You know, you can talk about this is the closest background, but of course, be careful, because anything you write here is admitted prior art and may be used against you. You know, just like they say as regular lawyers who practice that normal kind of law, you know, keep your mouth shut because it can and will be used against you. So, you know, you want to be careful what you say. Use it to your advantage, but be careful. Don't admit what your invention is. Don't make it obvious what the solution is when your invention, what you're claiming is the solution. Okay, summary, again, is actually an optional section. Track the claim language. Write it in plain English. Instead of using comprising as we do in claims, use regular English. Write as close as possible, and it might be what a judge or a jury is reading to determine infringement, because when they read your claims, they don't understand all the saids and comprising and so forth. So they'll read it there to understand what your invention is. Drawings are great. It makes your life easier when responding. It just makes it easier to read your application, because you can look back, read the drawings, there's your method flowcharts, there's the pictures of it. Drawings are obviously required if you have device claims. Method claims, they're not necessarily in all applications. As soon as I finish drawing, just to answer this question. It's good practice to copy a relevant portion of the drawing in the response. So I actually put in my responses to the office action, be like, as I'm going to go into later in the examples, examiner, you cited Hart, figure 5B. Here's figure 5B. I put it right in the office action. Here's what I claim. Here's a picture. In that case, we'll put a picture of a neutral wire. But in any case, it helps a lot. I mean, sometimes I'll take, here's my drawing. Here's a drawing of the prior art. Here's what we claim. Here's why what I claim is analogous to my drawing. Over there, you can't possibly say it's the same thing. It doesn't show it. Burden of proof is always on the patent office. Burden of proof is to show it. If it's not clearly shown there, shouldn't count. not going to say you won't get a rejection, but it shouldn't count if it's not clearly shown. Okay, so I believe I've covered the drawing slide. So we have a question from a live webcast viewer. I found it convenient to find the article or as being inclusive. In the absence of a definition, the courts have construed or as exclusive. Would you care to comment? I'm not sure I totally understand the question, that or as exclusive. I mean, or, okay, the article or as being inclusive. So, or usually, I discourage using or language, as I think most patent attorneys would. Sometimes you have to, or sometimes really, you know, whatever, use your judgment. But or means that it's this or this, and either one could be cited against you. In other words, if I say the claim is limited to A or B, if the prior art is either A or B, then it logically follows that your claim is not novel because it has A or B. So if you say A and B, and only A is in the prior art and not B, now it's novel. So I think what the question is asking is, if I write it as or being inclusive, I don't know. I have trouble with this. I'd have to think about this more. Maybe I'll think about it over a break. But if you set it as inclusive, a patent attorney can be their own lexicographer and define things as they want. I think that would be directly against the logical, you know, what or means logically. I don't know. I have trouble understanding how it would be interpreted, because if you say it would be both things that is being inclusive, if that's what's meant by inclusive, then why don't you use the word and? I think that would be easier than trying to redefine the word. I don't know. I'd love, whoever wrote this, please email me afterwards. I'd love to discuss it further, because it is an interesting question. Another question I have here just came in. One thing I have done is to import the definition of a key term into a claim when necessary. Again, would you care to comment? Yes, I think that's a great suggestion, to import the definition. Because sometimes, I actually did this in a response to the office action that I'm about to file. I did it, and the examiner, and it was one of those where I didn't say defined as in the specification, and the examiner rejected it based on something that really wasn't relevant at all. He said, I hadn't defined it well, and it could read on this type of process and so forth. So I actually did exactly that. I took the definition, I threw it right into the claim, and I gave a response that way. I'm sorry, this is one I did already. And it actually worked. He cited new art, but it did work to overcome the rejection by just pulling the definition in. I said, that's not what I mean. He said, yeah, well, I can say this. Well, okay, fine. So I put those words in there, rejection gone, new rejection. You know, that kind of thing. So I think that is a great suggestion, to just import your definition in. And I would add, not necessarily in the independent claim, but put it in the dependent claim. So the independent claim is rejected because he says it's this. Hey, it's in your dependent claim and you're covered. All right, so moving on, next slide. Be expansive in your application. Patent applications, you look at Thomas Edison's patent for the light bulb. I think it was 2 or 3 pages. They used to be very short. They were, today they're more like 10 pages, assuming it's, you know, the way they print it, single space, small font, that type of thing, you know, comparing apples to apples here on the font size. They're much longer. You know, I think a lot of that has to do with, we have computers. You don't have to go to the secretary. He uses the eraser stuff on the typewriter I don't even know what it's called. I'm sorry, that's how young I am. The stuff they use to erase what they typed on the typewriter. And I'm hearing this from an attorney I worked for who's in his 70s now, that since you go to the secretary at 4 p.m. on a Friday and you want her to change something because you need to file it, she's not going to be too happy. All right, so I'm just going to finish this slide, and then we're going to pause. So don't limit yourself. Be expansive. You might put in disclosure comprising of and consisting of. You might say either, because in your claim, you might have to change it from you comprising, which is more broad, to consisting of. So you cover that in your spec, so you have support if you need to change it. No new matter after filing, unless it's a CPA. So get it all in, as I've been harping on a lot. And don't talk negatively about the technology or the prior art. Remain positive about everything you're saying. I think that will help you go a lot further to not become argumentative, you know, more than you need to on the legal arguments. And we're going to pause now to enter code 1.
Please take a moment to write down LawLine.com's verification code. LawLine.com's verification code is the word trial, all in lowercase, T-R-I-A-L. Trial.
Okay, welcome back. All right, so we're on the next line, claim drafting with the office action in mind. So this is more or less a rehash of everything I've been saying, but this all comes together now in the claims, and this is a good conclusion for this section. If you have support for variations, you'll be better prepared if the patent office finds art that reads in some of your claims. You can always amend them. And sometimes, as many of you know, the art really isn't that close, but if you can amend, then you can overcome the prior art in that way. Make your claims count. Include novel variations dependent claims. When I first started at one of my firms, I had this great set of claims, and the attorney, he knocked them all out. He knocked out my claim like 4, 5, 6, 7. He's like, "There's nothing new about that. Great, you're adding that it emits a sound. That's not new." And in retrospect, you know, I was happy at the time, but I think he's right and learned a lot. You know, you're adding a claim that it's going to be the same rejection, or it's going to be it's something that you could reject easily by citing it somewhere else. You want to make it hard. Make your claims count. Make them things that are really novel. You don't have to use all 20 claims. Sometimes you can't find 20 claims. You don't have to use them. But, you know, then you might fill it up with different variations and different combinations, because, as you know, multiple dependent claims are very frowned upon. So you might take a dependent claim, put it twice, whatever it is. So draft your claims to what's new and obvious, but it'd be as broad as possible. I think that goes without saying. And there's two schools of thoughts on the office action. I worked for two different firms prior to starting my own firm in 2007. And one attorney I worked for, he would say, amend your claims. He would say, first office action, I always amend the claims, let the examiner feel like he won, feel like he got something. It's good negotiation strategy. Start with more than you want. Start with a claim maybe a little broader than you think you're going to get. Negotiate down. I worked for another attorney after that, another law firm, and he said, fight. Draft your claims the way you want them. Fight, fight, fight. You don't want to change it. You come up with festo issues, which just briefly is when you narrow down, the courts have said, you can't possibly have the doctrine of equivalence applied to the things that you've narrowed down. You're making it much harder for the litigators later. So, two schools of thought. They're both valid, and I think depending on what case it is, what type of application, I might do different things. Parenthetically, the one that said fight, fight, fight was more in telecom, and the one that said narrow down your claims was more in devices, mechanical things. So if that is a factor, I don't know. All right, we're going to go on to the next section, non-prior art rejections. So these are rejections other than 102, 103 rejections. So when you first receive an office action, so here's again different schools of thoughts. Do you send it to your client without comment or review it first? Well, it depends, but I would say in most cases I found clients want comment regardless of their sophistication level. But the sophistication level of your client might determine what kind of comments you give. For example, I have a client who is the foremost expert in a certain chemical field, like one of the foremost in the world. So I get these office actions. She knows a lot more than I do. Patent attorney can't know everything in every subject. Well, nobody can, but your inventor hopefully knows their field. Not always, but hopefully. So in that case, I give her some comments, I explain what the rejections are, and I say, here, would you review this? In other cases, I basically say, this is what's going on, but, you know, just practice-wise, I don't necessarily give too much because, hey, I need them to pay the bills. So I'll say, you know, here's what it's going to cost to respond. I mean, some people I know take retainers ahead of time. It's not as much of a problem. You just go straight forward. Personally, the way I do it is once the office action comes, it's 2 and 3 years. I don't want to do the trust accounting for 2 and 3 years later. So I then will then bill for reviewing the office action, have an examiner interview, and then again, once we've done all the preliminaries, then I will bill again for the written response. Is generally how I do it. Some clients you bill by the hour. As I said already, how well do you understand technology versus your client? And keep your goal in mind. Respond in the best manner to get the broadest claims allowed. That's what we really want. We want a good patent. Sometimes it means lowering yourself a little and saying my client knows more. Other times it does in fact mean my client really doesn't know how to read this, doesn't care, doesn't want to be involved. He hired me to do it. I take care of it. I'll figure it out. I'll learn it. I already know it. Maybe I understand the technology area better than him. I find that happens in many cases too in different technology areas. When I do telecom patents or that type of thing, which I do a lot of, I find oftentimes I'll go to a client and I'll be like, What do you mean you don't know what ANI is? That's what you do in your industry. So anyway, it happens. All right. So next slide, parts of an office action. Cover page. First thing you do when you get the office action. It has the mailing date on the cover. You use this for calculations, as you should all know already. So this is what I do. I docket the dates. Typical dates are as follows. 1 month, I'll ping the client. Personally, the way I do it, I have an automated invoice system. I send the invoice right away for the review, and 30 days, it sends them a reminder that their invoice is overdue. And then I'll get the reminder too, and I might call them up and say, what's the deal? Do you want to go forward on this? Usually it's, yeah, okay, we do, whatever it is. And then by 2 months, you should begin doing the work, if you haven't already, because you want to get in by that 3 month regular deadline. It's true, it doesn't cost that much for waiting past 3 months. I know many lawyers in general, it's just patent attorneys, will often wait till the last moment. I prefer to get stuff out quicker. That's just my personality, I suppose. And once you start waiting, you start losing patent term extension if you wait over 3 months. So that can decrease the length of your client's patent. So I try and get in by 3 months. And by 5 months, if your client still hasn't told you one way or the other, preferably in writing, because you don't want to get sued when you don't have in writing that they didn't want to respond, incessantly ping your client, capital letters, urgent, urgent, respond, warning, warning, that type of thing. 6 months, it's abandoned. That's it. You pay fees from 3 to 6 months, as you know. And now let's get into the office action summary on the next slide. It's not always accurate, but it does give you a roadmap. Often, at least, the bigger things are right. You may want to take the allowed claims to protect them, file a divisional for the rest. So often you'll see claims 16 and 17 are allowed, they'll ask to reject it. When you talk to your client, well, claims 16 and 17 are useful to us, so let's take claims 16 and 17, we'll file a divisional. It's true, it's another extra $1,170 right now in issue fees, at least $530 in filing fees, but it may very well be worth it because you don't want them doing more search rejecting. You want the burden of proof to be on your side, your client's side, to say, hey, this is a valid issued patent. You want to talk otherwise, you go and prove it, rather than risk losing those claims. If the office is final, you need to tread with more caution. Final, practically speaking, often means you just owe the government more money. As John White will tell you in the patent bar class that I took, if you didn't know the answer to a question on the patent bar exam, look for one that has money in it and choose that one, because often the answer is you fix it with money. So be on top of your client to respond quicker, because now the clock's working against you. If filing a request for continued examination, you can treat it like non-final but pay the money. But same thing I would try and do with 3 months deadline and so forth. If you do it by 2 months, there's the added benefit of if you respond within 2 months after final, the examiner has to at least tell you if they'll accept the claims or not, and you get something of more on the record from the patent office telling you about your claims. All right. Going on to the next slide, this is just a picture of the actual front of an office action. You can see the mail date is 3/23/2011, so then your regular response date is 6/23. I bother my client right away about it. He gets an automated reminder 4/23, and by 6/23, I hope I've gotten a good answer out of him. If not, we're in trouble. All right. And then on the right-hand side, response to communication, it tells what day I filed, actions final, non-final, and you can see that there is claims 1 through 20. There's a restriction requirement, which I argued against, and we're going to go through that next, overcoming that restriction requirement. It can be done. So the next slide is on restriction requirements. Again, I'm assuming you at least have taken the patent bar exam. You know what a restriction requirement is when I talk about this. It's separating two inventions into two different patent applications because the patent office says you're trying to patent world peace and thermonuclear warfare in the same patent application. And they say, no, those are two inventions. So there's two criteria for proper requirement for restriction. And this is often misquoted on office actions. This is something to look for. From MPP 803, A, the inventions must be independent or distinct as claimed. And, notice the word and. Office actions often seem to be correcting this lately. They often say or. Incorrect. There would be a serious burden on the examiner if restriction is not required. Serious burden. I've gotten things that say, oh, it's a burden, as we're going to go to. That's very nice. It's a burden on you. My job, everyone's job, what we do, life can be a burden sometimes. The legal test is a serious burden. If it's going to trouble you too much to do your job, I'm sorry. I'm filing a response arguing against that. So it's rarely applied properly, but overcoming it is also hard, but getting easier because it's being applied left and right today, which is why I'm spending more time on this than you probably would think I would. So restrictions, next slide, restrictions are increasing. Overcoming is also increasing. This is an example. I found John Dudas's blog. He's the former USPTO commissioner. He said that in 1993 in biotech, there were 1,000 restrictions for 32,000 office actions. 2008, 22,000 restrictions for 42,000 office actions. I find it hard to believe that, quick calculation, more than half of patent applications filed in biotech were for two totally different inventions. But that's what they do because, practically speaking, the patent office gets double the money, the examiner gets double the time to examine your patent application. But overcoming is also rising. So this is a source from Patently O blog, which is a great blog, and I recommend everybody. Get lots of great statistics on there. I love his stats. Biotech, 54% overcome the restriction. So these ridiculous number of restriction requirements, people are overcoming. Chemical, 21%. Computer, 6%. Mechanical, 18%. All right, moving on. Example is restriction likely to stick. So this is what I showed on the cover sheet of the response. Claims 1 to 10 are drawn to it. This is a direct quote out of the office action. Claims 1 to 10 are a method of making, whatever, an article manufacturer, class 265. Claims 11 through 20 are a device for making the exact same thing in class 425. So the prior art search revealed that for the past 20 years, all the close of prior art was restricted like this. I tried, you know, for let's try anyway, let's make a point. Didn't work. I didn't get through. I didn't actually petition, I just responded to the arguments. You know, you might try petitioning, but in this case, I didn't see it as so worth the client's money because I had seen in the prior art searches every time there's a method and device for the same thing in these classes, didn't happen. So in the office action, the next slide, you can actually see he put a pretty thorough restriction, which I'm seeing more and more. He used the proper word and, as you see is circled, and he said, one or more of the following reasons may apply. So he'd actually go through and say which ones apply. Now it's up to you. You want to argue against it? You got to argue against all of them and say none of them apply. So different classification, different classes, subclasses, the state of the prior art, so forth. So oftentimes a different classification thing, you might look at the, you know what, I'm going to hold off on my comment because I have it two slides down. So, next slide, example of restriction you may overcome. This one, may overcome, I did overcome. Claims 15 through 20 are a method of playing a game of chance. Claims 11 through 14, balls for a ball selector. 1 through 10, the ball selector itself. I had a three-way restriction on this. Three ways, balls for the ball selector and the ball selector itself. Truth be told, logically, I think you can hear maybe some why you'd have restriction on that. But in this case, the first two were in class 273, the slightly different subclass. The last restriction was in a different class. So the office action, there would be a burden of search on the part of the examiner. I just do a Scooby-Doo. Huh? What do you mean? That's your job. As I said before, there's a burden? That's not the legal standard. I didn't respond that way. I didn't say, that's not the legal standard. You know, I responded. MPAP 803 says, blah, blah, blah. Here, the office action states, blah, blah, blah. The two are not analogous. So what I did first is I look at the examiner's search report. It's right after the office action. A lot of people probably never look at a search report. I find them very intriguing. You see exactly how the examiner searched. Did he take 5 minutes to do the search because he was just moving on to the next one, didn't have time? Or did he do four searches over a three-week period of time, and he really looked into this? To give you a big clue, you know, one way or the other, where the examiner's holding. So what subclasses did they search? Now, if in his search, after you get this restriction, he searches class 273, subclass 269, subclass 144A, or, you know, all of them that were in the restriction, look, examiner, you've already searched it. There's no search burden. There's no search burden if you've already done the search. You could say the prior art is in both of those classes and subclasses. The prior art that you searched, that's in there, that you found. Look, it's referred to. It's actually placed in both classes. And always refer to the language of MPAP 803. And I, you know, use quotations, quote it, makes it look more formal because it is. Because you're showing this is what the procedure is. This is the procedure to follow. So, as I kind of went over the next slide, a winning argument. You have to provisionally elect one group. You got no choice. You must say you're electing with traverse. You must say traverse means I got arguments. You must provide arguments with your traversal. You can't say traversal without arguments or it's treated as non-traversal. Best argument that I found personally, I don't know stats on this, but that I found that's worked on more than one occasion is what I call the intertwinement argument. It means that my claim in group one, has features A, B, C. Claim in two has A, B, D. So you might say C and D are different. But look, D is a dependent claim in group one. C over here is a dependent claim in group two. You're going to have to do the same search anyway. You want to say the different classes? Well, how are you going to reject the dependent claim? You got to search that just the same. It overlaps it. Sometimes you might even draft claims with that in mind. Because restriction requirements are so prevalent, you want to make sure not to have a restriction. So, or to overcome it, you know, you intertwine your claims between the method and the device, even if they're different, or between two different sets of device claims, because I want to try this claim, I want to try that claim, to use different limitations, but I'll cover the other limitations in a dependent claim down in claim 14 and 16. So I can say, look, there's no search burden. And I have one on that argument. Okay, next slide, a winning argument. Patents of any one of these groups likely placed in each subclass. You might say on the front of the patent where it lists the class and subclasses, the one searched and the one that is placed in, you can see both of them. So the examiner will argue, as I already spoke about, independent claim has this, that one has the other things. So, as I called it here, you preempt it, and so forth. I kind of already discussed this. Oh, the other argument down here. If we follow your logic, because this one has feature D and this one has feature E, and you're saying they need to be different, well, why don't you do that for each of my dependent claims which have a different limitation? This argument I actually got from Diane Gardner. I'm wondering if you're watching. You might say there's an eight-way restriction. You might say that there's lots of different restrictions here. You might say that each dependent claim, you're saying because these independent claims lack a feature different, well, if that feature is over here, the dependent claim under this one, hey, you restrict that one too. And now that you're restricting that and that, instead of a two-way restriction, now you have a four-way and do that both ways, you might come up with an eight-way restriction based on the logic being implied in the restriction requirement. And, you know, if restriction requirements were better, or you might say if examiners had more time to examine, then, you know, we wouldn't have to go through these charades. I don't want to be spending so much time on it, but unfortunately, you know, restriction requirement tends to, I hesitate to say something negative, but I think it's very overused, but I think most people would agree. All right, rejection under 101. So 101, quote the statute. I'm quoting it here, quote it in your response. New and useful process, machine, manufacturer, composition of matter. In practice, most 101 rejections for properly written applications are in business method patents. So if it's in something else, patent office is probably right. Not always, but if you have a 101 rejection because you're claiming a signal is one that they don't like, that one you got to know. You can't say signal. You have to say, use other terminology. You're claiming ball lightning instead of a method of creating ball lightning. Creating a method of causing it to happen. Okay, that's a proper 101 rejection. But in software, it comes down to the wording. As you know, Bilski, Supreme Court, transformation of matter tied to specific machine. So, you know, it used to be people would use the words computer readable medium. Then we went through a brief period where you had to say computer-readable storage medium. Now we say a processor configured to carry out the steps of blah, blah, blah. To me, it's a matter of wording. It's a matter of fighting with lexicography in an area that's very hard to define. Where do you define the limits of abstract versus tangible? And unfortunately, a lot of it is the economy. How many patents being filed? Oh, shoot, we have too many not being filed now. Politics, you know, what's the backlog? All sorts of different things. But it is a hard area to define, and there's many moving parts, and I don't think it's going to be a well-settled area of law for a while. So, you know, a lot of times you just call the examiner up, the examiner interview, or read what he wrote, go by the suggestion of what the proper wording is. All right. So, how to overcome many one-on-one rejections. Next slide. So, as I kind of spoke about this, we kind of changed the words of what we'll say today. Follow what's suggested. And you can't patent a law in nature, but you can patent the conditions for doing such a thing or whatever it is. You find another way to write it. And feel free to contact me. Feel free to send in questions if you want to talk about that more. Be happy to talk about it. It's an area I find fascinating. Where do you define the difference between abstract and tangible? Nothing's really abstract, but everything really is. You know, how do you define that? It's an area of science which is, you know, discovering all of these things and trying to find the God particle and so forth, and seeing, you know, where does this lie? Where does our created universe lie in comparison, or whatever you may believe? Prior art rejections. So next section, and prior art rejections. So that's all I'm going to say on non-prior art rejections. Now we'll go into the real meat. So the first review of an office action, the goal is to break it down to manageable pieces. This is, to quote many who have said such things as this before me, there's the emotion, there's logical things. Person known as the rabbi known as Ramchal breaks this down very nicely. It's actually where I'm quoting this from. See, I like to quote my sources. he wrote about the 1700s, and he wrote that certain things are dictated by your logic, or certain things are dictated by your emotion, and when you first receive something that's huge, you receive it with many different pieces, then your emotion will take over. Oh no, how can I do this? You look at this in the big picture, what do I do with it? So you want to break it down to its component parts. Look at each part separate and logically. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give my method of how I break it down into its component parts. How you look at each piece logically, analyze it, dispense with it, go on to the next one, and then your emotion will follow. You come up with the big picture, you understand it. So the way that I recommend doing this is don't get caught up in the office action. Don't even read the office action's arguments, because you're going to get caught up in what he's saying and you're not going to keep it straight. First component part you need to understand, what are you claiming? What's your invention? What's the quote-unquote essence of it? What's there? Based on what the essence of your invention is, based on what you're doing, you know, based on, you know, what are you getting at, then you can take that and you can understand it. Now, once you understand your invention, which oftentimes 2 or 3 years later, you got to reread it, reread the claims or the summary or whatever to refresh your recollection, you can go back, now look at the office action, look at what he cited, get a sense of what he cited. Read those. Read at least the abstract, maybe the summary, maybe the claims, maybe look at the figures, depending on how well it's drafted and what's intelligible in it. And understand that. You know, take notes as you're doing it. Okay, this is what I'm doing. This is what he's doing over here. You might know right away, all right, that's totally different. Or you might just, you know, maybe there is something there. You don't know exactly, but first get straight in your head what you're looking at before you get confused by what someone else is going to say about it. All right, so as I've written, the systematic order that I recommend, review your patent application. Review the claims first. Review the major prior art cited, look for differences. Once you do that, you know your differences, you're ready now to look at it. So, first start with a high-level analysis. I call this the LCTA method. Why? Because the initials fit and I made it up. Because I can't find any previous treatise, previous anything telling you how to analyze an office action properly. You know, I don't practice that regular law that most lawyers do. What's it called? IRAC. That's what we learned in law school, the IRAC method. Well, I call this the LCTA method of responding to an office action. So, before we get started, next slide. The slide's name is Before We Get Started. Check the earliest filing date of each cited reference. Make sure it's a valid prior art citation. Until 2013, at some point, the law is changing. It's first to file. Prior art is only going to be, it will be used against you unless it's your own public disclosure within 1 year. That part of 35 U.S.C. 102B is remaining. But we won't be able to swear behind other references as far as I understand. I'm not an expert in that area yet because I got time to learn it, right? Okay, I should know it better. But in any case, until 2013, we can swear behind a reference. Make sure the earliest filing date is more than 1 year before your filing date. If it's not, call your inventor, or in many cases, I've sworn behind references simply by looking at the... My files are electronic, and I know the exact date when I did the first office at first draft, the novelty search, when I got disclosures, it's all dated in my file system. I have backups. I've just taken my directory listing from my backup system. You know, I've gone into use Linux for everything. I've gone into it, given a directory listing with the date, the file permissions. Here it is. This is proof that he had conceived of it and had actually reduced it to practice in that case and showed us beforehand. All right, welcome back. I'd just like to encourage people to send in questions that if I don't answer them during, I'll answer them at the end. Time permitting, I think we'll have some time, and we could also go a little bit extra to answer questions if need be. So feel free to send those in, and I'll answer them as best I can. All right, so we're still on the before we get started slide. Look at the search report. I talked about this a little before. See where he searched. Did they find a lot? They spent a lot of time. It gives you some clues. You know, if they did a comes out 50 pages of search, actually it's lines, this might be 75 lines of searching, and you can see they search all sorts of different things, you might be satisfied that, hey, they probably found everything out there. You're not getting too much new art necessarily, but once they understand your invention, maybe you get more. It'll give you some clues, at least, that you can look into it. Reality, most first for office actions are poor. Again, that press for time thing. A lot of office actions no one responds to begin with. No one looks over them again until they have a final office action, and then maybe it'll see another set of eyes. Sometimes I've heard attorneys that will use pre-appeal just as a threat to get the examiner to do something, because if he really did a lousy job, he's not going to want to look it over. It's not really a threat. It's really, hey, they did a lousy job, you're entitled to appeal it. And the reality is most office actions, they get at least one rejection, whether it's warranted or not. Some you get right through. Happens. I've had it happen a couple times. Make sure your information disclosure statement's in before the first office action for that reason. So that happened to an attorney once. He got a first office action. He looked at it, and his face went white. I haven't filed my information disclosure statement. That's a problem. You need to get that in. So he ended up filing an RCE to continuation just to get the prior art on the record, because he had a notice of allowance mailed to him. You know, that type of thing. All right. So, given, you know, understanding the reality of the situation, I'm just trying to give a pragmatic approach here. Then, next slide, step one is do the high-level analysis. What's the point? What's the problem solved? What's your technology doing? Review, refresh your recollection. That's something I stole from evidence class, refreshing recollection. I don't think I've ever actually used that in court, but refresh your recollection before getting sidetracked by the prior art. Know who you are before you let other people tell you who you are. You know, that type of thing. Any self-help book will tell you that. Put this in your head, and even better, write out a paragraph in your own word with citations. And not only that, if you write out that paragraph, this is what my technology is. It teaches this, and I quote it here. It's in paragraph 37, bracket 0037, and bracket. You know, it says this, and then my technology teaches this in that bracket. That paragraph you may very well use in your office action. You've written it out. It's definitely not a waste of time because, hey, you've done your work for writing the office action, too. Review the cited art. What's its point? What's it trying to drive at? You know, if it's a method for configuring a server, but it's configuring it at a very low level, like something like configuring your BIOS of a computer, compared to configuring a user interface, that's very different. I've had a citation like that where it's just opposite ends of the spectrum. Okay, they both say certain things. I upload the file from computer A to computer B, but other than that, hey, this is real different. So that sort of thing. Understand where your technology is. If you understand it, that's best. And in some cases, don't be afraid to consult your client. Don't be afraid to consult your colleagues, your other attorneys who might know the industry. If you know the industry and you can look at it, hey, all the better. But, you know, patent attorneys, we accept any client who comes our way. And we're hopefully good learners. You know, if a person comes to me and can describe the technology to me, you know, I like learning new things. That's part of the reason I went into this field. Maybe other of you did too. I like the fact that, hey, it stays new and interesting. I deal with clients, I deal with people, and they're in vastly different areas. They come to me, they explain their technology. I learn it. I learn about a new technology area, and I sound nerdier at dinner parties, you know, whatever it is. So I can talk to different kinds of nerds. I can talk to the electrical nerd. I can talk to the telecom nerd. I can talk to the mechanical nerd. It's very useful. So once you do that, once you understand what you're doing, high-level analysis example. So here's a real application. I tried to pick a somewhat simple application with a very straightforward office action, and decent office action, I might add. So we had written in our specification, and this patent is about to issue, but it's all public record that I'm giving here, anything not I've redacted, a spherical ball with internal transponder freely movable about an interior space such that the transponder falls to the gravitational bottom. What we mean in English is this is a bingo ball with a movable ARFID transmitter inside, a radio frequency identification tag, like your Easy Pass for those of you in different art units, shall we say. So this prevents the ball from getting lost by rolling away as... Oh, we have a question here. All right, I'll just finish this slide. This prevents the ball from getting lost by rolling away as the transponder is constantly working against the centrifugal ball of the motion of the ball. I thought that was a pretty cool argument that we put in there. So as the ball rolls, it's got this thing that's a counterweight basically stopping it from rolling too far as opposed to a regular bingo ball. And it does meet the New Jersey gaming requirements that I think, don't quote me on that, but pretty sure it meets the New Jersey gaming requirements because it is a balanced ball nonetheless. It's balanced the way it's produced and so forth. Further, as recited in paragraph 39, this is important implications for efficient reading of data on the transponder, as the reader is placed immediately below, I'm saying that loud because I'm going to refer back to that, immediately below or next to the known position of the transponder and the ball is in a resting position. So, we have a spherical ball, we have a movable transponder, it sinks to the bottom, you can see it on the next, it's actually not on the next slide, it sinks to the bottom, and now I have my reader below. Here's my ball, here's my reader, transponder right there. It can read it very easily because my ARFID tag is right next to my reader. All right, so I'm going to hold off on this question just to finish this section. High-level analysis example. Cited prior art. So he cites US 2006-0046837. All right, it's well before my filing date. 2006 publication. It was tends to be filed 18 months before, not necessarily. I'm going to publication dates. Filed, 2005, 2004. I filed mine not on 2010. I couldn't get behind that reference. But it's directed towards balls that are made of translucent resin with an ARFID tag. So it's a ball with translucent resin. How do you make resin? So that's a little bit of a, I don't necessarily know. I'm not an expert on resin, but, talk to people, you look it up. Wikipedia is sometimes a great resource. Wikipedia is your friend. Very easy to get information. Library might also be your friend. I think they still have those today. Most of it's on the internet. But this translucent resin, I'm pretty sure if you make something with resin, you're going to be making it solid. The thing is not going to be freely movable. So the examiner cited, or the office action cited, figure 3 of the Ito reference shows the ARFID tag 3 fixed to a plane passing through the center of ball 2. That's not the examiner. He didn't say that. That's my response. ARFID tag 3 is in a plane passing through the center of ball 2. So there it is. He cited that figure, and there it is. I put that figure right in the slide. You can see it looks like it's in the center. No reference has been located to whether the ball is hollow or solid, or that the ARFID tag is anywhere other than its fixed position shown in figure 3. The reference was not explicit. It really didn't say either way. I give the examiner credit. I think I would have tried that argument, too, if I were him. Seeing what the response is, his job is to make sure it's patentable. So here, client, or my client, attorney, whatever, look at this, and tell me, how is this patentable over it? You're supposed to work with him. It's not supposed to really be adversarial. Here, I've cited this. This has this problem. Let's talk about it now. That's the way I view it. Okay, you've cited this. Let's have a conversation. As Mitt Romney and they all say in the debates, and I think Obama used it before him, let's have a conversation. We ought to have a conversation about that. Until someone finally said, we're at a debate, Senator. We're having the conversation now. You're having that conversation now. Have the examiner interview. Have the conversation. So I had that conversation with him. Actually, I did this one in writing. And I said, look, it's not clear. Burden of proof, and I cited in the MPEP, the burden of proof for finding each and every limitation, it has to be in the office action. It's on the patent office. You have to cite this. It's not clear. And I said it very friendly, Well, it might be possible. It's highly improbable that that's what he's doing with resin, which is, I think, usually solid. And so forth. So that's the kind of argument that I made there. All right. Let's take the question. The question from the webcast viewer. I have several applications from the same inventor pending. The examiner continues to cite a single prior art reference so broadly as to almost preclude any further invention in that field. Yeah, here. I distinguish the claim language in our application from the claim language in our prior art invention as best I can. But this examiner is very stubborn. Is there anything further I can do? Well, I guess I would answer, did you have an examiner interview? I can give you this many examples, but I'll give you one example. A prior attorney had handled this case. You can look at this on my website. It's one of the patents I got issued. Because, hey, I'm going to talk about the ones I got issued, not the ones I didn't. So it's one that I got issued. A prior attorney had handled this. I think 2005. I took over in 2010. 5 years, he's going back and forth. And he just got so agitated. And he was back and forth with the same arguments. And he was largely right, but they weren't budging. He had never conducted an examiner interview. Never once did he talk to the examiner and explain it. I'm gonna hold off on answering this, the rest of this, but until we get to the examiner interview part. But that's big. Statistics show that when you have an in-person thing, you know, like I'm looking at the camera, what I'm looking at the camera and talking to and point to and whatever else I do, that's more effective than if I write it down and you read it. More effective when you make eye contact for someone. Taxi driver about to hit you. I had far, you know, getting here, I'm in lower Manhattan. Taxi driver about to hit you. You look at him. He sees your eyes. It's much harder to hurt someone when he sees your eyes. So that's the best to do in person. And you can really talk to them. Phone, second best. To do a phone interview because, hey, maybe you're not in the Washington area. I'm not. Arlington, Virginia. It's expensive to go down to Virginia. Clients don't want to pay you for that. Some attorneys, they'll build up like, hey, five examiner interview, schedule them the same day, take the train down, come back next day, whatever it is. You know, it's not a bad idea. It's a good idea, actually, because that's best. Talk to them. Talk to the examiner. There's other things you can do. If you have a final rejection, notice a pre-appeal. Did that once. I did that recently in an application where they keep citing based on a provisional that was filed, which just based on things that were in the non-provisional, using the provisional filing date. I swore behind the non-provisional, and he's still citing things in the provisional. Got nowhere with the examiner, got nowhere with the supervisor, pre-appeal brief. Worked very well, but then they really did the job, and I really got a new rejection with totally new art and totally new arguments. You know, client's not so happy about that, but hey, that's how it goes. You know, the idea is to get something patentable, everything out there. So that's really a way to get it to move. There's also, you can petition to have an examiner removed. I've never done it. I don't recommend it, but hey, something to throw out there, petition to remove an examiner if he's really doing a terrible job. But you better be right, because you want a petition to have him removed. He's still handling your application. I wouldn't want to be in that situation. All right. So high-level analysis recap. So we've reviewed our claims. We've looked at the prior art itself. We've picked out differences in the claim features. Now we're ready to look at arguments in the office action. We're ready to, now that we know what we're talking about, we've written what we have, what they have. What does he say in the office action? So here's the LCTA method. Maybe it'll teach us in patent law schools. Next to IRAC, you take the patent law class, LCTA. I don't know. You know, I'm not so happy with those initials. Maybe we can come up with better initials. Send me an email after to come up with better names for this and better initials. But remember, an office action is improper unless each and every limitation is cited in the prior art. Practically speaking, they have to talk about each and every limitation, show it in the prior art, or say, it's obvious. Yeah, great, you added a light bulb. Anyone can add a light bulb to that. You know, if you're not Edison with the light bulb patent, it's not obvious there. But today, adding a light bulb to something is generally pretty obvious if that's the only thing you're hanging your hat on. All right. If 103 is used, they must give a proper reason for the combination. Often it's very conclusory. Review KSR. Cite KSR. CFC cases are good as well as BPAI, Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences. Cite those cases. Those are often very good because they're more on the practice area, I find, than the higher level courts are more on, you know, bigger issues, and there aren't as many of them. But BPAI cases, you can find some good stuff in there about claim language and so forth and obviousness and whatnot. So, you know, you can cite it against the examiner. He's going to have to look at it. He's not necessarily going to know it. He's not going to be up on it. Not a lot of people are. It takes time for these things to filter down. But he must give a proper reason for the combination. He must say why he's combining the two references, what the rationale is, why you would do that. if he's citing using my BIOS example and a user interface example, and he's smashing together, he said, well, it'd be obvious because, well, hey, he'd want to upload data too. It's really tough to win those arguments, to be honest. To win the argument saying it's not obvious to combine, he'll say, yeah, it is. No, it's not. Yeah, it is. No, it's not. It's like arguing with your brother when you're six. But, you know, you might want to put it in. The best argument is to say, hey, feature is missing. Even if you combine all these references, this feature is not shown. So, LCTA method example. Here's what I'm talking about on LCTA. Systematic method of breaking it down to its component parts. Limitation. What is each limitation in your claim? Break down. You might want to do a claim chart. Claim chart, here's a limitation, a few words of what the actual limitation is. Here's what's cited. I'm going to paste it in. Citation, is there a citation? So, there should be. Look at the citation. Once you have the limitation, look at what's cited. Text, I like to copy the cited text. If they cite all of column 2, that's a little much. You might then go in and see which part of column 2 and copy that paragraph. But better is usually they'll cite like a paragraph. Copy the paragraph over. And analysis. Now you can look at it. Now I've got on one side, or right here on top, here's my limitation. Not the whole claim, the limitation. You know, you might want to do this for ones that are obvious you can breeze past and say, okay, yeah, all right. Even if he doesn't cite it there, he'll cite it somewhere else, or whatever it is. But here's my limitation. Here's my citation. The citation over there, it might have nothing to do with the limitation. I've broken it down to each and every limitation and citation. That's what you need to do. Is that citation on point to that limitation? If it is, move on. You know, don't argue what you can't argue. Make your office action count. You don't want to have your good argument down on your 18th page of your response because you've decided to argue every limitation. Have you, you know, make your office action all good arguments. Make it look like you know what you're doing. You're serious because you want to be good patent attorney and you are. All right. And analysis is citation correct. That is LCTA. Limitation, citation, text, analysis. You cannot argue against them without looking at the text. Well, you can, and you might be right, but it's a much better idea to actually cite the text. What is the limitation? Each and every limitation. What is the citation? What does he cite? What does the text say? I like to put it right in my response. This is now something I came up with all on my own with the magic power of cutting and pasting from a patent. You can cut it, paste it right into your OpenOffice or MS Word document. There it is. Okay, here's claim 6. Here's the citation. Sometimes I might do, here's the limitation in claim 6. Here's what it's talking about. Here's a quotation from the specification. Here is the actual cut and paste of what you just quoted, examiner. Say office action, don't make it personal. What the office action quoted. Here is why that does not equal that. And do that over and over. Rinse, wash, repeat. All right. Carrying out LCTA method. LCTA method. So here is an actual example. I'm going back to that spherical encasement with a hollow interior. Citation. Each ball comprises, this is exactly what he wrote in the office action. Each ball comprises a spherical encasement with a hollow interior. See figure 3. That's the whole line. That's why the word the is at the end. Each ball comprises a spherical encasement with a hollow interior. The text, well, here's figure 3. I use this example because, hey, it's a picture. Less reading for you at home in the office. Here's what he cited. Figure 3 is not enough to show hollow. Now, I went back here. I read the specification. If it says hollow in the specification, you got a problem. You know, you want to not only win on the office action, you want to get the patent issued. So if the specification said hollow, I wouldn't have bothered arguing this. But it didn't. It didn't say hollow. But based on that picture there on the slide, do you know that that's hollow? I don't. I don't know that's hollow, that's solid. I can't tell in the specification, in the citation, was silent. So I made that argument. So, that was one of my arguments in that application. And by the way, this patent again is about the issue. It worked. And the restriction requirement got removed. It worked for all of the claims because I argued the entanglement argument and say, look, each of the dependent claims cites things in the other groups that you're telling me are not elected anyway. And he called me with minor revisions, claims or whatever, and he's like, that's a pretty good argument. And he let it go. Nice guy. I like that examiner. All right, carry on LCTA and another claim limitation. Here's another example. Limitation, a near-field communication reader below an exit tube. Okay, same technology, same patent application here. So the citation. So again, the reader is below an exit tube. Here's the reader. Here's the exit tube. Exit tube here, reader over here. It's got to be below it. So citation. Well, the ball selector also comprises a near-field communication reader, antenna 48, which is below an exit tube, ball recovery box 32, paragraph 67. All right. I'll give it that it is, that I think it's correct that antenna 48 is probably the is equivalent to an RFID reader, or, hey, maybe it's obvious that if there's an antenna for some other kind, RFID reader would be there. But I found a better argument than arguing how a proven antenna's RFID reader. Text, there's no recitation of antenna 48 in paragraph 67. So it's paragraph 67 and antenna 48. Now I got to go searching. Okay, he should have done it better. He didn't. Too bad. You know, that's life. That's what happens. We got to make sure that it's novel over the prior art, whether they cite it or not. So I find it myself. So as I've written here, it's not enough. It's not in the office action. You got to really have a patent here. You want to come back and argue, and I've seen this many times, come back and argue, the office action doesn't cite this. It's not there. Well, now you got a new final rejection and does cite it properly. Good job. You know, it's something. It takes you to the next step. If it's all you got, hey, make an argument, maybe it'll work. But there's, if you can make a better argument, like, you know, one that gets you patent, it's a lot better. So I found it actually paragraph 68. All right, maybe it was a typo. Maybe it's a 68 or 67. But point being, paragraph 68. The direction in which two balls move, the antenna 48, as part of the previous sentence, the antenna 48 is disposed between the rotating discs 45 and 46. The antenna 48 has rectangular coils surrounding the guide duct 47, which describes figure 8. So I look at figure 8. The antenna is not below the exit tube. There's the exit tube along the bottom. You can see the ground designation with the horizontal line with the dashes. And you can see that the antenna is actually a coil around it. So I said, hey, that's not an antenna below the exit tube. Argument number two. First argument, it's not hollow. Second argument, and there's no real disclosure of hollow. You can't cite this as saying hollow. All right, that's argument number one. Argument number two is, hey, look at this. That's not below the exit tube. So, conclusion of second LCTA example. In this slide, first thing is limitation. The reader or the antenna is below the exit tube. That's the limitation. The reader is below the exit tube. For this purpose, I didn't argue antenna. You might have. Reader is below an exit tube. Citation. We looked further, and so the citation was bogus, as I wrote. I never actually have said that word in my life, but apparently I write it. Now I've said it. But we looked further, and we found a proper citation of the antenna. So we look in the text. It shows an antenna and a coil around the ball, not under the exit tube. I'm sure it was an exit tube. I don't know. I'd have to refresh my recollection. Analysis. The prior art citation does not show reader below exit tube because the reader is actually around the ball path and above the exit tube. So I guess I wrote this, I was looking at it. I guess it was above the exit tube, and maybe it wasn't even around the tube there where it's exiting at all. All right, and you repeat that. Next slide. Repeat LCTA for each and every limitation. Each and every limitation. The rejection under 35 U.S.C. 102 and 103 are treated exactly the same in this regard. Look at each and every limitation. Does it cite it properly? Then after that, you can argue whether the 103 combination's proper, but again, finding it's not in it is much better than arguing it's not obvious to combine when it's in both. All right. So if you can find a proper citation for each and every limitation, it happens. Don't argue it. Sometimes you get really good art against your thing. You got to amend. But prove it to yourself. Prove it. Line it up. Do the LCT analysis. Do it for each one. Find out. This is this. This is that. If not, you're throwing away a good argument. Make sure each and every limitation is really cited in the prior art. And then if it is, you got to amend the claims. You know, that they, it, again, it happens sometimes. And you can add more limitations. You can take a limitation of dependent claim. For example, limitations are all found in the independent. Well, I'll move something in the dependent in the independent to argue it because the examiner fudged on that. I found that's common as well. They might give you a very good rejection on the independent claim. The dependent claim, they go and cite nothing. You know, look at figure 5 for the neutral wire, if you remember that example from the beginning. So, you know, you might just add that in and say, hey, it's not there. You can take the limitation. You can add a limitation for specification. And you know, narrow your claims or change your claims as long as it's in your specification. Keep your high level and LCT notes in order, because now we're on to the next step, the examiner interview. So, examiner interview head slide, and we're going to pause here for code 2.
Please take a moment to write down LawLine.com's verification code. LawLine.com's verification code is the word trial, all in lowercase, T-R-I-A-L, trial.
Okay, so we're at the examiner interview. You can go on to the next slide if you haven't already, which is titled examiner interview. It starts with etiquette and good manners are critical. It gets you much further. It really does. When you talk to the examiner, I mean, if you can personalize it, you can talk to them as a friend, and, you know, one examiner talked about how she'd drop her kids off that morning, that type of thing. You know, but be sincere about it. You know, be sincere and talk to them, and talk to them like a person. Don't get on the phone all angry. They're not going to help you. Statistics show that there's shorter prosecution, greater allowances when an interview is conducted. I once saw statistics on the Patently O blog. I couldn't find them to cite them in this presentation, but I do remember seeing them. And in those, as I said before, you can answer the question, in person is best, telephonic is second best. And, you know, I'm actually curious, to the person that questioned, what can I do? The examiner won't get off this one piece of prior art. Did you try an examiner interview? And, you know, feel free to send me a follow-up, because I'm curious to interact with you and find out what did you do and what didn't you do, and maybe we can move further. Often it's easiest to explain and have a give and take when it's oral. You put it on paper, it's just kind of written there, whereas if you're having a conversation with someone, you can say something and say, wait, did you mean this? And then you go back and forth with them and say, no, I didn't mean that, I meant exactly this. And you get back and forth and you clarify, and that can work much better. You know, I think it's logical. It makes sense. When you're talking to someone, when you're able to converse with them, you're going to be able to get more across than just writing alone. Of course you're using writing. You have to respond on paper. There's actually a rule that you have to respond to an office action on paper to create a written record if there's a rejection. But this supplements it. More than just visual, it's also auditory for the examiner and so forth. Don't shake his hand. Hey, do even more. And you can also, not only that, it works the other way. Maybe you don't really get the examiner's rejecting. You don't get why he's saying it. So now that I've talked to him, it's like, oh, that's why you're rejecting it. And he explains it to you, and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, I got it. And now you can amend or do whatever it is you need to do. All right, when to have an examiner interview. Having an examiner interview is like voting in Illinois, or like it used to be when it was more corrupt than it is now. I don't know. The Bolshevik guy, whatever, I guess it's still corrupt. But vote early and often. Have an examiner interview early and often. Before the final rejection, an examiner will have more leeway to act. They actually have an hour per application to talk to you. Once they get final rejection, they might tell you they're out of time. Usually I found they're willing to talk to you, but they're not willing to do more searching, more stuff, more whatever. If you can explain it early, once you've explained it, you put it down, then you put it down on paper, and now it's before final, they'll do more searching, they'll do more stuff for you, more cells, whatever, more understanding. And you have a better shot. After final, I'm pretty sure it's part of the rules. They just can't do as much. They're not going to do further searching. And typically what will happen in an examiner interview is they'll say, I got to do a further search. So, okay, I understand. You're right. Okay, that is novel. I had one excellent interview where I was on the phone with the client, and I was on the phone with the client, and he was an electrical engineer. You can look at that patent on my website. It's issued too. Two more of his are on the way, actually. And we had an hour back and forth with the examiner, and we explained it. He explained it from the technical point of view because it's his field. He's got a master's in electrical engineering. I don't. You know, I have a law degree, a patent bar, I have an undergrad degree, I have experience. I don't have a master's in electrical engineering. So he explained it much better. He's talking to the examiner, and I explained it from a legal point of view, and the examiner said, okay, I'm going to declare this novel over the prior art, and we had to then put it in writing, and we got it issued. In most cases, they'll say, oh, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Put it down on paper, I have to do further searching, which is code for, okay, you probably have a pretty good argument, they're going to search it further because they think they can probably give you another rejection. So that's life, that's what continuations are for, that's what happens. But we hope to get it through, you know, quicker, because we want to bill our clients less and do an honest, good job, right? Okay, so do your homework. So your homework is the high-level analysis I talked about, the LCTA analysis I talked about, and be prepared with a claim amendment. They usually want it faxed to them ahead of time, sometimes emailed. Be prepared to explain the difference over the prior art. Know what you're talking about before you get on the call, you know? It's basic. Know what you're talking about. Be prepared. Do your homework. And now we get to your response. All right, so your response. It's part one. Cover sheet, part two, the amendments, part three, the arguments, part four, declarations. Sometimes you have test results to support it, which are probably better to be in your specification to begin with, swearing behind the reference, that type of thing. So let's move on. Cover sheet. So you see on the slide labeled cover sheet, there's my file number, I blocked out some stuff, there's a serial number, the filing date, the art unit, the examiner. That's my block that I use. You know, most attorneys I found, they just, you know, two columns. I found, hey, you know, it's so easy to do this stuff on computers, let's make it nicer to read and more presentable. Presentation is big. I got that from an immigration attorney, actually. He said, when we're dealing with an immigration issue, he said, which unfortunately I learned too much about. He said, here, take all your stuff, put it in a nice binder where you see through pages, have it in order to show it to them one after the other. Same type of idea. Make it nice, make it pretty. Use nice fonts and so forth. Steve Jobs type of thing. State what it is. State what each item starts on. Now, that's not to exclude having substantive arguments. I mean, I think it should be clear by now. I'm all about having substantive, real good arguments. That's what you're really going to win on. So, response to the office action of blah, blah, blah. Interview summary begins on this page. Amendment begins on that page. Remarks begin on that page. Next slide. Interview summary. Examiner will provide one. It's a good idea to state politely what was discussed. It creates a paper record. So, interview summary, here's an examiner. The undersigned thanks examiner Sotomayor for the telephone interview December 6, 2011 and appreciates examiner's extra efforts in contacting the undersigned despite technical problems with the USPTO. A lot of problems with the phone system that day. The claims amendments submitted herewith were submitted for consideration during the interview, and during the interview it was agreed by both parties that the amended claims overcome the objections made in the office action. And, you know, said it very friendly and said, you know, not accusatory. The examiner admitted they were wrong. Doesn't win in arguments with your wife. It won't win an argument in the office action either. All right. You find a diplomatic way to say you were wrong, but don't say it like that. Don't let them, you know, let them think you're being nice about it because you're putting this on the record. And as my former boss told me, they don't need you for anything. You know, they can keep rejecting and make your life hell. They can do that. They work for the government. So you want to be nice to them and get them on your side. All right. Is, again, different strategies. Personally, this is my strategy. I find it works. Amended claims. Use status identifiers. So I'm just getting the meat and potatoes. It should be basic for those of you who have do this every day. Original, currently amended, withdrawn, canceled, and underline new text, strike through, deleted. You know, I'm just giving how you actually write your actual response. Next slide, remarks and arguments. State what the office action says succinctly. So here's an example. What's the rejection under? What's the allowance restriction? Claims 11 through 14 have been rejected under 102B as being anticipated in the view of blah, blah, blah. Arguments are provided below to overcome the rejections. The office action is further restricted examination to claims 11 through 14. Applicant traverses this restriction, and maybe it could have said for reasons that are stated below also or whatever to be consistent. State what you're doing. Are you arguing amended? There's a perfect example. Next slide. Writing up a response to 102, 103 rejection. How are we doing on time? Okay, we're doing perfect. We've got 9 minutes, 4 slides or so. Writing up a response to 102, 103 rejection. And again, this is your last chance to send in questions. As soon as I'm done, we'll have a few minutes for questions. Writing up a response to 102, 103. So paragraph on your patent application, basically what I said you should write when you're doing your high-level analysis. Here it is. Start with your high-level analysis. Same thing. You're going to have your office action, high-level analysis, low-level analysis after that. I'm not sure every patent attorney does this. This is what I think every patent attorney that trained me had ever did. And it's a great idea because I can now explain it succinctly before getting all technical on the claims. Here's a paragraph on what claim 11 through 14 say. Here's a paragraph on what the citation says. Here's the citation, what they're about, what they talk about, what the difference is between this and that. Now that hopefully the examiner has read that and understands the difference, he can then go into the claims and he'll have the same high level picture as I do that I have in my mind that I'm going to transfer to him. And he'll have, and then we can go into the claims. I conduct examiner interviews the same way. Let's start at the high level. What are we talking about? You know, let's break it down. This is what this application talks about succinctly. Take the emotion out of it. Here's 50-page thing. This is what it's talking about. I can sum it down for you, or the relevant parts, as best I can. Here's what this one is talking about. Now we can get into the nitty-gritty once we've done that, into the component parts. State the law. Actually, before we get to component parts, I apologize. One or two case with a legal test. There's an example. I'm not going to read it. That's a typical citation I might use to 102 with the legal test, and I might highlight certain things if the office action is not proper, but state it. Don't assume examiners know it. If they're new, if they're whatever, they don't always know it. They have something like, I think, an 8-hour training before they start responding. It's true that there's a supervisor over them in the beginning, but they're not reading every word that they write. 103, there's an example you can use in your office actions, copy from the PowerPoint presentation with the legal test. Key to supporting it is articulated reason why it's obvious and so forth. All right, then what do you do? So, you use the LCTA for each claim limitation. So here's an example. I've broken it down, and I probably would actually use separate paragraphs for each of these things. So this is a real example. Limitation. Claim 11 of the present disclosure is directed towards a plurality of balls, with each ball having a, quote the limitation you're talking about. And in truth, if I could have avoided that whole preamble thing before I did the quote, I probably would have, but I felt it was better here to put it in. Generally spherical encasement with a hollow interior. So it's got the feature of generally spherical encasement with a hollow interior. So the office action states, it's shown as follows, and this is actually a cut and paste from the response to the office action they actually drafted. So, I cut and pasted, my kids like to say I'm going to win you at that, but I cut and pasted, I took it out of the office action, Porky Pig moment, and I put it into my response. Here's what you cited, here's exactly what it is. I mean, the paraphrase, I don't need you to look over there again to see if I'm citing you accurately. Here's what you stated right there. Each ball comprises spherical encasement, blah, 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 and this paragraph and that paragraph and so forth. Now, I then get in my next paragraph the text and the analysis. As recited above I was referring to my high-level analysis that I talked about before, figure 3 fails to show that the spherical encasement is hollow. Rather, the RFID tag appears to be held at a central plane, implying that the ball is solid. No text has been located within the written specification of Ito one way or the other, Ito's prior art reference, and as such, the office action has not met the burden of showing that the prior art discloses each and every limitation of Claim 11. There it is. Further, as recited above, the balls are produced from translucent resin, so it is highly unlikely that these balls are produced hollow. And I went on and on, but therefore Claim 11 is allowable. There's the basic structure of the argument. Again, look at the slide. Here's the limitation. This is the exact limitation I'm talking about. And again, you need to decide each and every limitation. I cited that before, I cited that after I cited the limitation. Here's what the citation, here's what's in the office action. I actually pasted it in. I think I'm the first one to do that. I don't know. Someone else has probably done it out there, but I think it's a great idea. Examiner doesn't have to flip through papers. He doesn't look back and forth and get confused, because this is very confusing. You're looking at a lot of references, a lot of papers. Put it all there. All he has to do is read through the office action. Make it easy, make it simple, make it sweet, make it nice. I think that some of those were synonyms. And then here's the text of the office, the text of the prior art. In this case, the text is the figure. I think I actually did put in figure 3 in the office action. I'm pretty sure I did. I put in the picture of that ball. And then I put in my analysis. And once you're done with all that, we write our conclusion. So we have 3 minutes and no questions, so I will spend 3 minutes on the conclusion unless a question comes in. Please send me one. Conclusion. Please allow the claims. Simple as that. Withdrawal of all rejections and early acceptance of the claims is requested. We want to say, allow the claims, allow them in. All right, and then hopefully we'll get it allowed. All right, and we're up to the last slide, which says thank you. questions, you can send them in right now, and I will hopefully answer them while I think of delay and think of something to talk about for the last few minutes. And you can reach me. My name is Michael J. Feigen, Esquire. There's my email, michael@patentlawny.com. My website, again, patentlawny.com. Phone number, and one of those fun legal disclaimers to not get sued. This presentation is meant to be a broad overview and a teaching aid. Do not construe this as legal advice that is contained in this presentation. All right, so for the next few minutes, why don't I go back and address this question again? So let's go back to the first one, and let me try and analyze this one again. I have found it convenient to define the article or as being inclusive. I guess he means inclusive, or as in it has to say both A and B in it. In the absence of definition, the courts have construed or as exclusive. So, what I'm judging by context, exclusive because the court cases have said you can't use or. So let's talk about claim language for a bit. Again, each and every feature has to be cited. So if you say a claim limitation is A or B, and one of them is cited, that's a problem. It's your claim is not novel. If I say my invention has to have perpetual motion and nuclear warfare, and I say it has or, and the prior art shows Jess thermal nuclear warhead in the War Games movie, then that's a proper citation. It says or. So you say inclusive, it has to say both. It has to have this or this. I don't know. I really have to disagree with the questioner. I don't think it's a good idea to do that. I think you might as well just use the word and. Why rewrite definitions when the Boolean word and is out there and it just follows logically? If I say it has to have thermonuclear warfare and it has to have world peace in it, or whatever I said, perpetual motion, it's got to have both. Cover it that way, write it that way. All right. And I guess the other thing to talk about is just that when you write the office action, just again, make sure that you're talking about the relevant points. Keep it concise, keep it to the point, keep it very formal, keep it very polite, and make sure to harp on best arguments. You may even want to discuss claims out of order. And then when discussing dependent claims, generally what's I think is done in the industry, not just me, is we'll say, Claim 2 is allowable due to its dependency on claim, or the dependent claims are allowable due to the dependency on allowable claim 1. The dependent claims are further allowable for the following reasons. Continue. Claim 2 is allowable for this reason. Claim 3 is allowable for that reason, and so forth. And keep doing the LCTA method on each and every dependent claim you have. And when you do that, you cover all your claims, you cover it systematically, that makes for a good argument. And preserve all your arguments. Don't traverse without rejections. Don't traverse without providing arguments against the rejections, is what I meant to say. Otherwise, you've lost it. It's the same thing as regular court. If you're going to argue new, if you're going to have a second response, and you have, you know, you responded once already and you're responding again, I'd also like to incorporate all of the arguments I made previously. They still stand in addition to this. So, for example, I might do that where I get a restriction requirement before the first office action and the examiner maintains the restriction. So I want to keep I want to keep it. I want to say I maintain my arguments that I made there. In some cases, I encourage the examiner to read them. And, because he ignored them, and that's improper, that happens. And they might ignore arguments and say he has to respond to my arguments, and I preserve my arguments. And in addition, I make the following arguments anyway, get it all down on the record, that's your chance to do it. And that's basically, in a nutshell, responding to an office action. Please contact me, patentlawny.com, ask me questions, and I enjoyed giving the presentation. It's a little different, not in front of a live audience, but I hope it's good, and I would be happy, again, to talk to anyone afterwards. Thank you for listening.